Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Adams. This episode features content from an educational webinar titled Strategies for Optimal HIV Treatment and Prevention, answering the questions on considering an ART switch during pregnancy, featuring Dr. Annette Habel and Dr. William Short. Dr. Habel is a physician and head of HIV in women at the HIV Center Frankfurt in the Department of Infectious Diseases at the Hospital of Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. Dr. Short is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases in the Department of Medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. In this episode, they will answer questions and discuss key considerations when determining whether and how to switch antiretroviral therapy in virologically suppressed pregnant individuals, especially those who present on newer antiretrovirals that have limited data in pregnancy. For the full online educational program, please visit the link in the show notes for this episode. Now let's get started and hear what Dr. Habel and Dr. Short have to say.
So welcome everyone. My hope this will be a very informative session. I think this is a timely topic. It's something that I think causes all of us to scratch our heads and say, what do we do here? So I think it's important. What we're going to do first is I'm going to run through a series of didactics to sort of tell you what we know, what's in the literature, what's not in the literature, I actually should say, and then review some of the guidelines. And then I think at that point, I'm going to bring in my co-presenter, and we're going to have a discussion back and forth about what we do and how we manage these complex situations. I will say up front, and you'll hear both of us say it throughout, a large part of this is really meant for you. So we really want to hear what you have to say. We really want to hear your questions. You know, we're probably going to say right along with you, we don't know what to do here, but here's what we would do. So please take time, jot some questions down. We won't call you out by name unless you want to be called out, but we're happy. We really want to make this a session for you. So I think it's good to start out with, first of all, what do the antiretroviral guidelines say and what do they recommend in pregnancy? So I'm going to talk you first through the Department of Health and Human Services perinatal guidelines. And I will say that this is a working document. So we are in the process of updating this. And in the next couple of months, you will see some changes to this. But as of this presentation, this is really what we look at, and this is what we have recommendations for. Keep in mind, when you look at this, this is a general recommendation for initial antiretroviral therapy. So initial antiretroviral therapy means this person came in, was found to be pregnant, and is not on any antiretroviral therapy. We're not talking about people who come in on a regimen. We can get to that when we get through the discussion, but we're talking about someone who is not on therapy at all. And what's recommended, or what we call preferred, and I'll go through this in the next series of slides, like what makes a drug become preferred during pregnancy? We know for non-pregnant adults what that is, but what about pregnancy? So I'll go through what data is needed. But what we have right now is in the new combination, so the NRTIs, we have a couple different combinations. So we have the combination of lamivudine and abacavir. Obviously, the star there is to make sure you use that in people who have tested for HLA-B5701. And so a lot of times, if you're waiting for that test to come back and you don't have it readily available, that may not be the correct drug for you, but that is one. Other ones are co-formulations of emtricitabine with either tenofovir disoproxil fumarate or tenofovir alafenamide. And moving forward, just for the length of saying the full name, we'll say TDF versus TAP, but they will refer to each one of those respectively. And either or, you can combine the FTC or with 3TC lamivudine, and then again with those same combinations. So that's what's recommended for NRTIs. What you note is lamivudine and zidovudine are no longer there. They are moved down to alternative for reasons that we can discuss later on. In terms of integrase inhibitors, what's preferred is dolutegravir and raltegravir. And again, I am not going to go through all the specifics of each, but just know that there was an early signal a couple of years ago as a result of the SAPAMO study where they saw a potential signal of neural tube defects seen when taken at conception. However, with increasing data, increasing exposures, that signal is no longer there. And so it is a preferred instead during pregnancy. And then when we get to PIs, we have two ritonavir-based protease inhibitors, atazanavir and darunavir. And then again, dosing may change here. There are some alternatives. When you look at the insufficient, and I think that's an important point of discussion, we have bictegravir on the instes and doravirine. And I think bictegravir probably is a topic of lots of conversation because we know in non-pregnant adults, this is a very widely used compound. So what happens when someone is pregnant? Well, I'm telling you here from the guidelines, it's not recommended to start, largely due to insufficient data. And then really, when you look at not recommended, there's a whole list down here. I will draw your attention to the INSTIs and the PIs. Among the INSTIs, it's really any combination that has cobicistat as a pharmacoenhancer. We know that cobi is great when we use it in non-pregnant adults, but when we have physiologic changes associated with pregnancy, it causes the levels to go down significantly in the second and third trimester, and therefore you run the risk of breakthrough viremia, potentially resistance, and obviously you want to prevent a perinatal transmission. So you see here, both with the INSTIs and the PIs that are boosted by cobi, they are not recommended. And it's very few things that are not recommended during pregnancy. This is a hard stop because of that. And at this current time, the use of cabotegravir, which we'll come to later on as well, is not recommended. I'm going to turn to my co-presenter, Annette, who's going to give a different perspective, looking at other guidelines that are seen throughout the world. Annette?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Yeah, I suggested to add some other guidelines, also the German-Austrian guidelines, not because I think they are so important on an international level. But I just want to point out, looking at the different guidelines, the European one, the British guidelines, WHO, and our German, Austrian national guidelines, that looking at the same evidence, we all make recommendations, evidence guided. We, using the same guide, we take different pathways sometimes. So, for example, rilpivirine, Bill, you showed in the US guidelines, it's not really recommended. We have it as preferred. So that has historic reasons. We have been using NNRTI for the treatment of pregnant women for a long time. So we still want to keep one. So we just switched when updating our national guidelines in September 2020. We just switched from nivirapine to rilpivirine. Before rilpivirine, really nivirapine was still recommended as preferred. So you see the slight differences between the guidelines. The BIVA guidelines, they don't recommend INSTI for the treatment of pregnant women. That's also interesting. And I was surprised to see that the US guidelines recommend a nuke backbone containing TAF with no restrictions. EX guidelines included now a TAF containing regimen, but only from pregnancy week 14 on, so not any earlier. I think we're going to discuss maybe the IMPACT 2010, the Wested study. So from studies, really, we only have data from week 14 on, but of course we will come to the pregnancy registry later, and then we'll see we have some other data on top. But just to point out different guidelines, looking at the same evidence and drawing different conclusions and recommending different drugs.
Great.
It's not that much difference, but there is some difference. So with that, I give back to you, Bill.
Thank you. So what is missing from the guidelines? And I think this is the bigger question. And here's where I think all of us sort of turn to each other and you know, say, what's happening here? What do we do? How do we manage these patients? And what are the data with the new agents in pregnancy? And I think these are extremely important questions. So I think the most important thing to note is that often plenty is missing. So we know that when you look at registrational trials, and this is pretty much universal, unless you're looking for a pregnancy indication, individuals who become pregnant on study are often removed from the study, maybe followed, but they're actually pulled out of the study. And also it's typically an exclusion criteria. So we know that when a drug gets FDA approved, we're sort of left with, this is a great drug to use when you're non-pregnant. What happens when you become pregnant? And so you really do, the scale really fits it perfect. It's really a balancing act. So you got to look at what are the benefits of maternal treatment, right? You need to make sure the person takes the antiretroviral, they get virally suppressed. We know that viral suppression is one of the most significant factors when we talk about perinatal transmissions. But then you have to balance that with all the adverse fetal effects. And it will bounce back to maternal effects as well, because we know some of these may be associated with preterm delivery. Some of them may be associated with gestational diabetes. So there's this really balancing effect that you have to do. And then Annette and I are really going to talk about the patient is extremely important in this case, right? So we know what the data is showing us, but we also have to consider what is something that the patient can take to achieve that viral suppression. So there's all these things we juggle that we typically don't have to juggle as much. I don't want to say we don't have to juggle when someone's not pregnant. And the problem is what's off to the right is you have minimal data to make these recommendations. So a lot of it is just expert opinion and what's out there. In general, when drugs become preferred, so when you look at my list of preferred drugs, the reason they're preferred is we look at three different things. Efficacy data. That efficacy data typically comes from non-pregnant individuals. So trial comes out, drug gets approved, and I'm going to talk about cabotegravir, rilpivirine for a second. We know the ATLAS and FLAIR trials were published. We know that they work. So that is great efficacy data. What's often lacking when a drug gets approved are two things: pharmacokinetic data during pregnancy, because we know the drug levels can change. There are tons of physiologic changes throughout the body, not only volume of distribution, enzyme induction, all these different things that change concentrations of drugs. So we need to know how that drug plays in an environment where someone is pregnant. And then safety data. I sort of talked about this. What are adverse maternal effects? So I talked about, you know, high blood pressure, diabetes, you know, pre-eclampsia, all those things, and then birth defects. So there's a lot of things that are often lacking. So summary from this slide is once a drug is FDA approved, we're often missing those last two bullets: pharmacokinetic data and safety. And I'll just quickly say for pharmacokinetic data, there was an excellent paper published that showed it's usually a median time of about 6 years from the time a drug is approved before we get any pharmacokinetic data. So you can think about that with newer drugs that were just recently approved and people are getting pregnant on those drugs. We don't have any of this data there. Probably the longest slide I will talk through, but it's the most important. I want to put a plug in because one of the pieces that we need, and this is where we could use your help, is getting drugs and looking at birth defects. And a lot of that data comes from the Antiretroviral Pregnancy Registry. This is an exposure registry that monitors outcomes of women that are exposed to antiretrovirals during pregnancy. I'll put a plug in here. It's not just HIV. They also take a look at pre-exposure prophylaxis, post-exposure prophylaxis, and hepatitis B. But we're focusing on HIV in this presentation. There are a couple ways to register your patient. So it's totally voluntary for you to do it, which is often the problem. It's not mandated. So we know that not everyone submits to this. And I will say roughly in the US, we get about 10% of the reports. So we're lacking. And I'm going to show you why that's important. There's three different ways you can report. A prospective report means you see a patient today, they're 16 weeks, you register them with the pregnancy registry, so they're registered, and then once at delivery, you give an outcome. That is a prospective report. That is what's included in the primary analysis I'm going to show you in the next slide. Retrospective reports, which means you can submit them anyway, you get the outcome at the same time as the registration or clinical trials, they're often not included in the prospective reports. So what we really want is prospective reporting. And I listed over here some of the exposures that we look at. I don't want to make this a focus on the Antiretroviral Pregnancy Registry. There are other CCO talks where I discuss those. And then we look at pregnancy outcomes. And here's what we have to date. And this is updated every 6 months. There's a couple different principles. So in order to be included in this, so if you went down here and you're looking, you say, why is bictegravir not in there? Why is cabotegravir not in there? Well, you need to have a threshold of 200 first trimester exposures to be included in this primary analysis. Why? Because that threshold of 200 is sufficient to detect a greater than or equal to twofold increase in birth defects. So they're not going to put something in there that has 100 exposures. And so as you see, as of the last cut, this is not yet calculated for bictegravir, cabotegravir, or doravirine. So reporting is essential. My last plug.
Oh, sorry, Bill. May I just interrupt you because you complained about people not reporting to the APR. Maybe I can tell you something about the problems we have in Europe or the challenges, because since 2018, there is the European General Data Protection Regulation that applies to all the countries of the European Union. And therefore, it's not that easy to get patients' data from Europe to the US, because if I want to report data of a pregnant woman, I need an ethic approval, I need a signed informed consent. So it's really crucial to report, but there are barriers for reporting due to this data protection regulation. And maybe we should discuss that another place, how we get data to the registry. And that's one of the reasons why most of the data comes from the US in the APR.
Look it up how
other countries or other regions contribute, and there's only a small amount coming from European countries.
Yeah, and I can tell you in the US, a large number of the factors go into it are, you know, I don't have dedicated staff to do this. I don't have access to the outcomes, right? Because you're not attached to a delivering hospital. There's lots of reasons why only 10%. But, you know, if you're able to report, it's extremely helpful. And I think the dietegravir signal was really critical. We saw that signal, and it wasn't until we got all those number of exposures. And I only covered 200 here, but if you want to look at, this is overall birth defects, but if you want to look at something that's rare, like a neural tube defect, you need 2,000 or 3,000 exposures. So if you go down this list, you know, we don't have many that have 3,000. Most of them, you know, we need, you know, they're chugging along. Zidovudine, we probably have the most for. Actually, tenofovir, we have the most for, because they're widely used. But yeah, no, very great point to bring.
But you're right. Don't get me wrong. I underline that it's so important to get this registry data. And it's no excuse for the European countries. I just wanted to comment. We are working on it, and it's really getting difficult, but we'll find a solution.
Well, thank you for doing that. I just want to share two slides with you. And again, I'm not picking on, but again, what's commonly used in clinical practice, you know, I not only care for pregnant individuals, I also care for non-pregnant. And so bictegravir is very commonly used, right? So here we have the PANA study that gets preliminary bictegravir PK data in pregnancy. And actually what Annette and I were going through the slides, I think she commented like, that's two patients. And we're like, that's two more than we had. But again, the data is so limited. So we get excited when we see two patients. But if you look here, you know, what you see is two different patients, and then they look at the concentrations. And I won't go through everything, but you can see some of the data is missing. On the second patient, the concentration of 4 hours and postpartum, all these are critical things, right? These are hard studies to do. And then on top of that, you're taking someone who's pregnant, you're bringing them in, you're giving them an antiretroviral, and then you draw blood for all these different hours. Very, very difficult to do. But some things we do know, that cord blood and maternal blood ratios indicate that bictegravir crosses a placenta. And then both women had viral loads less than 50 in the third trimester, and both babies were healthy with negative HIV DNA PCRs, meaning that they did it. But again, very small numbers, but data is data, and we need to get it out there. The other one is cabotegravir or piperine PK in pregnant women. And, you know, again, I think you're going to see more and more of this, not only from the treatment trials, but also from the HBTN trials where they use cabotegravir for PrEP. But here, this was 26 of 325 women who are reproductive potential became pregnant while exposed to greater than or equal to one dose of cab and ropivirine, both the oral and the long acting from the studies. And then you can see the breakdown here. Again, it's really just to show you the limited number of data. You can see there were 11 live births, 8 elective abortions, 7 spontaneous, 0 stillbirths, and then 11 live births here, breaking down all virally suppressed. 1 reported congenital ptosis in a preterm infant with intrauterine growth restriction. And we know that if you look to the right, I think one of the problems is, not a problem, but it's a pharmacokinetic property of this drug, is that when you give long-acting CAB and rilpivirine, we know there's tails, and you see that they are off to the right. So a lot of times, you know, if you're given an oral drug and someone gets pregnant and you stop the drug, you know, it's going to wash out. Here, it's a little different. You're talking about that drug being around for the entire pregnancy and probably longer. So once the patient is on this drug, they're going to be on it throughout the pregnancy. So I think that's really important to remember. And I always say, take this back to your clinic. When you're starting someone on this who's of reproductive potential, counsel, counsel, counsel. The time to counsel is not when they come in and say, I'm pregnant, because they don't come in at 1 week. And even if they did come in at 1 week, that drug is going to be on board and it's going to remain throughout the pregnancy. As long as they're shared decision-making, let them know there's no data in pregnancy. And that's really, really critical. I think my last two slides, and then I'm going to bring Annette in so we can start really having a discussion and answering some of the questions, is what about two drug antiretroviral regimens? So we know now guidelines actually do recommend for non-pregnant individuals two drug combinations, dolutegravir plus lamivudine, and then dolutegravir plus rilpivirine. So the guidelines in the US actually say pregnant patients who have successfully maintained viral suppression on those two should probably continue it. And the reason why this is different than the CAB rilpivirine is we have data on dolutegravir 3TC, lamivudine, dolutegravir rilpivirine. So we have data on that. So we have the efficacy data, we have pharmacokinetic data, and we have safety data through birth defects. What's different is it's two versus three drugs. And it was a huge debate in the panel. And so they said, you know, patients who are on these and become pregnant, have a discussion, but you can actually maintain them on that and monitor the viral load more frequently, especially with the rilpivirine where there's lower drug levels due to the physiologic changes in pregnancy. So that's what's recommended. So with that as a background, you know, I think it's important to talk about what do we do when someone becomes pregnant on a new regimen. So I think the first part of the discussion was someone comes in, they get a new diagnosis, and you need to treat them. Versus, or someone comes in, they've been off their antiretrovirals, you want to treat them, we have the guidance. But I think the more relevant question is, what do we do when someone becomes pregnant on a newer treatment that isn't yet recommended by the guidelines? And I think the last two were it, on a bictegravir FTC TAF regimen or long-acting CAB rilpivirine. So then I'm going to bring you in to the discussion.
So, yeah.
Actually, I'm sorry, that's a hard question. I'm throwing you right under the bus.
Yeah, so I could answer, it depends on, yeah, that says nothing. But I would really look at the patient. So what does she need? What does she feel comfortable with? So does she really want to stay on the regimen? Where does she come from? Pre-treatment is important. And the first thing, the most important thing, you mentioned it already, Bill, is to keep the viral load suppressed. So that's my most important thing for prevention of mother-to-child transmission. So in first place, we have to keep a suppressive regimen, and then we have to look for safety data or data we have on this regimen. And I tend to involve the patient and discuss it with the woman, and then hopefully we agree on one decision if we keep the regimen or if we want to change. And, you know, a switch always carries along some risks. So the woman might not tolerate the new drugs, then might not be that effective, even especially in pre-treated women. So it's not that easy to answer. The best situation is if a woman of childbearing potential is treated with a regimen, she can easily get pregnant on, and we have enough data. But that's, you know, that would also mean that we treat young women with outdated drugs and strategies sometimes, and that's not okay either.
No, I'm right with you. All right, so let's turn to the audience and do some voting. Again, just a reminder, we're down to our last two didactic slides after we do this poll, and then we're going to really start delving into the questions and answers. So let's move forward. So What would you recommend for a virologically suppressed patient who becomes pregnant while receiving co-formulated bictegravir FTC TAF? And I'll go through the choices. So A, switch to an ART regimen that is guideline recommended in pregnancy. B, continue, I'm going to from now on say BF TAF throughout the pregnancy. C, counsel the patient on available data and let the patient decide whether to switch ART or remain on BF TAF, something else, or E, I'm uncertain. Why don't you go ahead and vote now? Maybe while we're waiting for the answers, I'll take a stab at this. So this happens all the time. Patients, you know, are referred into the pregnancy clinic where I manage, and I work in combination with an OBGYN. It's a co-located clinic, so they get both care while they're there. And often I have a discussion, and a lot of times they may have come from a provider where there's no discussion of this, and really let them know there's, you know, no data on this drug in pregnancy. But the problem I have is people are coming in at 17, 18, 19 weeks. So a lot of it past the first trimester and really past that early period where we have, yes. And it's okay to show results. And it's really about having that discussion. And actually the poll just came through. Yeah. So the majority of people here, so 66% would do choice C, counsel the patient on available data and let the patient decide whether to switch ART or remain on BF-TAF. And then 21% say switch to an ART regimen that is guideline recommended in pregnancy. And then 12% say continue, and then 1% is uncertain. And I will say this is really what I see in that. I'm not sure if you do, so it's a combination of B and C. And then occasionally I will have a provider from the outside who's seeing the patient switch them, and then I get them in the clinic. So do you, any comment from you on that or?
No, yeah. You mean in terms of the answers or?
Yeah. Would you do in your clinic?
I would have chosen answer C. I think that's pretty clear. I would counsel the patient on the data we have, I can offer, explain what they could mean in this individual case, and then we would hopefully decide together how to go on with the AIT. And I was just wondering, Bill, may I ask you, when we say, when I say we should treat young women so that they can get pregnant at any time point and we don't have to switch. So that would mean we would treat them outdated maybe or in an old-fashioned way. Do you think we treat young women and young men differently? Do we offer different AIT regimens to them? What do you think?
No, it's a great question. I agree, we don't. So I think, you know, Where I practice at, everyone's doing rapid starts, rapid initiation. So if I come in, I'm newly diagnosed, most people are getting, most people are getting BF-TAF. Mm-hmm. So that is happening right at the gate. And again, I don't think there's not a thought about pregnancy. There's not a thought about pregnancy intentions, but it needs to be.
And I think because most pregnancies are unplanned. So we have to be aware of that.
Totally agree. So that's what's happening. And then I feel like it's pregnancy happens and then, what do I do? But no, I think the efavirenz story was one where there was a lot of discussion when efavirenz was there was a signal for. People were saying, well, if this is someone who's of childbearing potential, they should not get efavirenz. So there was a lot of pushback about that. Should you really be focusing on populations and saying you don't have access to this drug? And I think you hit it, and we talked about this before we started the series, is that a lot of times, you know, this may be what the person tolerates. And I use that when I think of an injectable. You know, I know my patients who get injectables, there's a reason they want an injectable. They don't want to have the pills. It's a constant reminder. There's many reasons they want it. Simplicity. They don't have to worry about missing it. maybe they live with someone who doesn't know their HIV status. So they have comfort coming to my clinic every other month, you know, and we're not thinking about pregnancy. We're thinking about, I want to get this person healthy, keep them healthy. And then all of a sudden pregnancy occurs. And so do you then pull off the injectable and put them on an oral when oral probably won't work and they go home and don't take it? So yeah, these are all amazing questions. Yeah. So let's move to the next question. I think this is a very similar one. And I sort of started out because I'm always 10 steps ahead of myself. What would you recommend for a virologically suppressed patient who becomes pregnant while receiving long-acting cabotegravir or rilpivirine? Switch to an oral antiretroviral regimen that is guideline recommended in pregnancy. Continue long-acting cab and rilpivirine throughout the pregnancy. C, counsel the patient on available data and let the patient decide whether to switch ART and or remain on the long-acting injectable. D, something else, or E, I'm uncertain. So why don't you go ahead and vote? And I will say, just reminder that there are no right or wrong answers here. So I don't want anyone to think because you picked A versus C, that's not, one's not right, one's not wrong. That's why they're polls. Waiting for the drum roll. Okay, so it looks very, very similar to what we had before. So 60% would counsel the patient, let them decide. 30% would switch to an oral ART, and then 5% would continue throughout the pregnancy, and then 5% uncertain. So very similar to the last one. The only thing I will say for choice A is that while you're switching to an oral, which is what the guidelines at the current time recommend, just keep in mind that you will still have that exposure throughout most of the pregnancy because of the pharmacokinetic tails. All right. So I think that sort of ends the didactic, and we did have a little bit of discussion in there, which I think was relevant. So I think at this point we plan, and we actually have five. That's great. We have five questions. So I'll start reading. So number one, do you counsel patients on the risk of neural tube defects with dolutegravir? How do you approach this conversation? Maybe you'll discuss this in the presentation. I think we touched upon it, but Annette, I'm happy to start.
I mean, this counseling is in terms of non-pregnant women because conception is a critical time point. So I do counsel my non-pregnant women of childbearing potential. We could easily say young women, but there is no significant difference anymore. So I think the last analysis was dolutegravir 0.15% neurotube defect and versus 0.1% in the non-DTG arm. So this is not significant anymore. And Bill, you already commented on it. As the number of pregnancies was increasing in the CIPAMO trial, the signal went down and the percentage. So there is not a significant difference anymore. But I'm happy to share our knowledge with the patients. And so I also tell the whole story. And then when they say, what would you recommend? You have choices. We have lots of drugs I can offer, but this drug might have advantages. So integrase inhibitors, of course, are recommended for non-pregnant patients. So I don't want to I don't want to not give it to young women. If they need it, if it's a good choice for them, they can have it, of course.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the updated CIPAMO data from 2022.
I have the 21 data here.
Yeah. So it's really just that there really is. So it really is preferred if you plan to conceive and through pregnancy. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Number two, one of the things I would like to clarify, is there a regimen that is recommended throughout pregnancy, or should we be changing regimens or withholding ART in the early weeks of pregnancy? I am not caring for pregnant patients now, but maybe adding some to the practice in the future. So I think when you type that, we had not covered the other areas. So I think there are regimens that are recommended if you're naive. I think the bigger question comes up. So wherever you practice at, I think if you open up, you could see dolutegravir with emtricitabine, tenofovir, disopraxil fumarate if you practice in the US, or tenofovir allophenamides preferred. I think the bigger question is, what do you do with those last two questions when someone comes in on those regimens where there's insufficient data? What do you do with those? And so, and again, I think all this has been covered, so I'm hopefully not repeating it, but when you are on those regimens, you also have to be concerned about switching, stopping meds and then switching. So you have a lot of changes already going on, and now you're going to pull off one medication and add another medication. You worry about the risks of, you know, nausea, breakthrough viremia. So all of that's a discussion. So again, it's all about counseling. And so switching is really not, I think most of us in the field would say, if someone's on a regimen, tolerating it, even if we don't have a ton of data, with counsel, talk to the patients and continue on if they were in agreement. You agree, Annette?
Yeah, and once again, I have to mention this magic sentence. You only use that drug if the benefits outweigh the risk for the fetus or the woman. And then this calculation, we discussed it already, Bill. This is hard to do for clinicians because we don't have the data on this drug during pregnancy. And that's all, and you also mentioned it, caused by the small percentage of women included in clinical AAT trials. I think I read this number, 19% the study participants in AAT trials are women. It even goes down to 11% when it comes to cure trials. But then if a woman gets pregnant, this is usually an exclusion criteria. So we just don't have the data. So how could we then calculate benefits and risks? So I think that's really hard stuff for us to do. And thank God there is a paradigm shift undergoing. So it's now more not protecting pregnant women from research, but protecting pregnant women through research. So there's really a call to action to include more women and also more pregnant women in clinical trials. Not the very early ones, of course, but then the later stages of clinical trials. We really, and that goes out to all of us, we really have to include more women to get data earlier and get data from prospective trials. We need the registries, but you know, the best is to get prospective data from randomized trials.
Yeah, and like you said, there is definitely a paradigm switch.
Yeah.
All right.
Lately, so, yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Not that it's happening. There's a push.
Yeah.
I'm excited. Lots of questions here. I'm really excited.
Yeah.
We were worried that no one was going to ask questions. So I have switched patients on Biktarvy early in pregnancy, but didn't change if they were presenting late. Does that make sense? So yeah, I see this a lot where if you're early on, people are changing. Again, I think it's all what we said, a clear discussion. And then sort of a follow-up to that is, don't we have a lot of registry data yet? And so the answer is no. Keep in mind that the data cut that we look at, and I don't know if we could go back to that slide, because I think I'm actually looking to pull it up.
Yeah, so, right. I think in the APR, we have 140 pregnancies, yeah. And I looked it up, 91 periconception exposure. So we don't have this 200 yet. Maybe when it gets updated in January 2023, the 200 will be reached.
Yeah, that's the problem. So
yeah,
that's the big thing, is it's first trimester exposure. Mm. So if you reported someone who came in 18 weeks, that's, you know, that's not going to count as a first trimester exposure. So we'll look at that, but it's really first trimester exposures. Yeah. And then on top of that, it has to be that prospective reporting. So it has to be that you submitted your case, registered it, and then reported your outcomes after. So they can't, the registration, the outcome can't come at the same time. It has to be separate. So that's why it doesn't include it. But yeah, so you can see here, as Annette just said, very clearly. We have 183 with five birth defects and then zero in the second and third. So you're right. We do have more than 200, but they're split between first and second. And so it's definitely still continuing to be monitored.
But you also believe next January, next update, we will have the 200 first trimester exposures, right?
We will.
Probably.
Yes. We will for sure. For a patient on CCAB, CAB doesn't change and stop the exposure issues.
Yeah, it doesn't stop the tail exposure.
Right. No. So the tail is going to be there. The tail is going to be there, you know, for a year. You're definitely going to have that tail for a year. Obviously, the drug concentrations are going to go down over time, but you're really going to have that exposure throughout the pregnancy. So you will definitely see it. And there are great curves. We don't have them here on this slide deck, but there are definitely curves that actually show this. Some of it come from the HBTN trials where they use CAB for PrEP. You can see the tails. There's stuff from the registrational trial. So all that is out there. But yes, the tails will definitely still be there. If you are using a two-drug regimen, how often should one monitor viral load?
Well, you should answer that because you included that in your guidelines. You addressed it. We didn't even address it in Europe. But I think you do a very close monitoring, right? 1 to 2 months?
Yeah, so it's every 1 to 2 months during the pregnancy. And this is a change because, you know, when you're evaluating someone who's pregnant, the obstetrical staff are very clear about when they do testing. You do prenatal labs, you do third trimester labs. And so then here we come along and we're doing monthly. So it sort of adds that complexity of doing more viral load testing. But until we have data, I think it's important to do that.
But Bill, may I just ask you, how often do you check the viral load in pregnant women on a recommended regimen?
Yeah, so if someone's on a recommended regimen or, you know, once a trimester, so first trimester, second and third, if they come in the second and third, and there's always that viral load at weeks 34 to 36 to determine.
Yeah, before the calculated date of birth, right.
Do we need a cesarean, do we need to have an elective or discussion about cesarean delivery? But there's no, and again, this was a really great discussion about this, you know, two drugs versus three, right? And it's the question was, and my point was, we base things on efficacy. So if you look at efficacy, efficacy shows that a two drug regimen looks very similar to a three drug regimen in non.
But you have an integrase inhibitor in it, so I mean.
So, but what's often lacking is those other two. But for those two we mentioned, dietegravir, lamivudine, dietegravir, rilpivirine, we do have pregnancy data. We do have, you know, if you even come down here to the APR, you can see, and of course, it's very small print, but rilpivirine is definitely highlighted. So we have that data. We do have data on emtricitabine. We do have data on lamivudine, and we do have data on dietegravir. So we have all the components. It's just the true drugs makes people, you know, everybody gets nervous when someone's pregnant. Unless you're taking care of pregnant patients all the time, people tend to get nervous. But we do have data on all those other components. Yeah.
And I would also continue a two-drug regimen. I would not start it during pregnancy.
Exactly. So, I totally agree.
Yeah.
Starting is different. Mm-hmm. All right. If you have a patient on Biktarvy with Prescobix, the patient prefers to keep Bic, would you just change the Prescobix to, I'm assuming the Prezista Norvir? Yeah, I mean, I can tell you what I would do. So yes, I would do, that's the one thing I do often make sure. I have a discussion, but I do let them know that I am going to do this with the Cobicistat. I often do that. I will change out of Cobi and into Norvir. So you're right. Mm-hmm. So if you look at this regimen, the person's on Prescobix, and I'll come back to that in a second. So this person's on Prescobix. Remember, Prescobix is once a day with a single booster. The recommendations during pregnancy are to go to twice a day darunavir with ritonavir, again, due to PK levels. So, you know, if you were keeping a person on this and you were going to make, if you were going to make some switches, I would do Biktarvy, and then I would do darunavir ritonavir BID, not once a day. Anything to add in that?
No, we do it twice daily as well, because that's the same evidence due to pharmacokinetic reasons. And women are not very happy if they had one pill, a single pill regimen before, and then they have to take the drugs twice daily. But most women are willing to do so because it's also for their baby.
It's also, this is a hard area because, you know, if I'm seeing a patient in clinic and they're getting antiretroviral, whatever, we're going to say X, and I have a question about that, I can call lots of other providers. I feel with pregnancy, there's very few of them. We're a small
community.
Everybody else I ask about pregnancy, their hands go up and say, ooh, I don't know.
They're probably people call you. So
so it's really, it's very difficult. Yeah. And then again, you're left with this kind of data. Yeah.
There are only a few challenging areas in HIV medicine left. And one of those definitely is HIV in pregnancy.
Yep. All right. We have 7 minutes, so I'm going to get the next three.
Four.
I also like to offer PrEP if the virus is now fully suppressed. Great. Thank you. So thank you for a great presentation. Yeah, I think that's wonderful. You know, we're not talking about PrEP in here, but I think when I talked about the pregnancy registry, remember, they also capture data on PrEP. So I think it's important if you do have that exposure, it is an antiretroviral and it is during pregnancy, you can actually report that. You also contribute. So great. And thank you for your comment. For women who are pregnant and recently received CAB injection, any thoughts about starting oral therapy like Dietegravir and Descovy despite previous CAB injection? The million dollar question. It's a million dollar. I don't know. I'm happy to take it, Annette.
Well, there are recommendations for switching from injectables to oral. You should make sure you switch if the woman gets it every 4 weeks. You have to switch in this time period, these 4 weeks. And if the woman gets the injection every 2 months, this is your time period, you should switch to oral combination. Or didn't I get the question right? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. So
it's a kind of parallel. Don't wait until the date of the next injection. That's the latest time point to switch to oral.
Yeah, and I think the guidelines make it vague almost. So switch to a preferred three-drug regimen is what they say. So again, if you're going to do dietaryoscopy, I think your question was hitting at you're having double exposure of the integrase, and that's always been one of my concerns. And I will say there's no data, but I totally hear you, because that's one of the things I always say is, what if I have someone who's on an integrase and they have that tail and now I'm going to add another ICSI and there's no data? Can only MDs do the data registry? The answer is no. And I'm happy to share and talk to you about that offline. But no, the answer is no. And so please, please, please share. If you could drop your email, I will email you directly. So in this case of a woman on cabrilpivirine becoming pregnant, what would you do? Is there a real choice in regard to the PTA? I won't say your name, but thank you. I think I'm going to read this to everybody because this has been my argument for a while. In the case of the woman on long-acting cabrilpivirine becoming pregnant, what would you do? Is there a real choice? In regards to the PKTL, she will be on it anyway. And I think we said that early on. You know, you can say we're going to stop the injection, but you are going to be on that exposure. So, you know, again, I think it all goes back to a discussion. And, you know, why did this person need long-acting cabrilpivirine? Is there a reason they wanted this, you know, that they didn't want to take pills? So all that needs to be hashed out. But you are spot on with person's going to be on that throughout the pregnancy.
Yeah, but there might also be a reason why the woman wants to stop now as she's pregnant. Absolutely. Maybe she does not want to have injections while being pregnant. So we really have to include women in decision-making. You are right. The PK tail, we mentioned it several times. You can't avoid it. And you have this top on top oral then. But I would leave it to the woman.
Yeah. I think one of the conversations I often have, so Annette and I, you know, we see patients is, you know, these conversations should often happen in the non-pregnant setting.
And yeah, that's the best.
they're not. And so it's like, how do we get people to, or providers, how do we get providers comfortable with this presentation? You know, because I think everything that was in here, you know, we're all going to walk away and say there's no right answers to anything here. Mm. Right? I mean, it's really individual. It's all based on individual patients sitting in front of us. There's so many factors that I could possibly not lecture to you on. But the question is, let's take it out of the OB clinic and let's go to the routine clinic where I'm walking in and seeing patient A, then I go in and see B, and each one of them, and you know, we haven't talked about trans men who could get pregnant. This is really focused on females, but you know, we can have gender diverse individuals becoming pregnant. Why do we not talk about pregnancy there and say, you know, I think it's important. And I get it. I'm a practicing clinician and researcher. It's very difficult. We don't have time. You know, when I think about, I have 20 minutes to do everything, see the patient, how are they taking their antiretrovirals? Are you up to date on this? Are you up to date on this? Your pap smear, your mammogram, monkeypox vaccine, COVID boosters. I mean, I'm probably missing a ton. Cardiovascular risk reduction, smoke cessation. Oh, by the way, do you plan on getting pregnant? And so, and I get it. I do it. I'm in there. And I often don't bring up those conversations either. But I think that's where we would get answers. And maybe some of us are afraid of those answers, because if someone says, I don't want to get pregnant, and you're uncomfortable talking about methods of contraception, then you're like, oh, I don't know what to do here. So they're very uncomfortable conversations. But I do think we need to swing these conversations into the general HIV clinics. You agree, Annette?
Yes, of course. And there has to be a more women-centered approach. And I think, like I said, it's a paradigm shift ongoing. And let's wait and see and push it forward, Bill, and all the others out there who are interested in this issue. We can do a lot, so each one of us. And well, what's your take-home message, Bill?
I think my take-home message is have a conversation, whether you're having a conversation during the pregnancy piece. Preferably you would have this when the person's not pregnant, or you know, sometime in your routine clinic, that we just lack a lot of data. I think that's one. But the other one is, and you know, I feel like I've done my job above, because I have someone who has an interest in reporting exposures to the registry, and they've left me their email. So I'm very excited. So I think anybody that can contribute data to this registry, I know it's an extra burden, but it is so important to get this data, because we're not going to have data to make these decisions that we're making. So that's my take home. I unfortunately snuck into it, and I'm sorry. You know, I always got to get that little last dig in there, but how about for you? And I think you have a little different, because you're coming from an area where you're really restricted. Your hands are tied in reporting.
Yeah, we even have difficulties to get data for our national HIV registry. Yeah, people do report to the national registry, but they do not report to the APR. And we wanted to find a way to transfer our national data to the APR, but that's almost impossible. So we have to find other ways, because really these data are crucial, and we need them, since we don't have data from studies yet. Maybe a change is coming, but until then, we use everything we can grab and then to make the best decision with and for our patient. I think that's important.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to thank everyone. I think it's really nice. You know, I look at the numbers because I like to see, and I know this, depending on where you're at, you know, that at least there were 92 at least registered people, or over 100, and you may represent clinics. So I think it's really important to see that many people are interested in this topic. And, you know, I really hope you learn something from it. You take back, I mean, learn that there's not a lot of data. We don't know really what we're doing, but I think it's okay to say that. And I just want to really thank you all for taking the time. Actually, I think there are two other quick questions, and then I think I'll stop. So I have two people now who want to report to the registry. So I'm overly excited. Sometimes the clinical pharmacist has time to have conversation. Yeah, I 100% agree with you. I got called to do doula education, and she told me she'd like to become pregnant, which she didn't tell her provider. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Yeah. You know, it's an important point that there are team members. It's a whole team out there, and you know, and patients feel comfortable with different individuals. So I know in our clinic, you know, the PharmDs are extremely important in all aspects. We could have never got off our injectable clinic without them. There is no way. So I think all members of the team play a critical role in this. And that's why having, you know, lectures like this that are really multidisciplinary, having everybody on there are extremely important. And, you know, when I try to talk about pharmacokinetics, I totally butcher it because that's not my area. So I do turn at all times to the pharmacist that work with us. So thank you for that comment. I really appreciate it. And again, thank you for your time and attention today.
Yeah, also thank you to the audience, and I'd also like to thank CCO for inviting me.
Thank you very much to Drs. Habal and Short, and thank you to our listeners for joining in. Please be sure to check back regularly for more episodes on important infectious disease topics. Thank you, and have a great day.